And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome William Boyle back to the program today. William is primarily a writer of fiction, and he was last on Book Talk to discuss his collection of short stories, Death Don't Have No Mercy. His novel, Everything Is Broken, was published exclusively in France, and his first published novel was Gravesend, and his new novel, The Lonely Witness, is set in the same neighborhood. William, The Lonely Witness is kind of a sideways sequel to your earlier novel, Gravesend. A familiar face or two pops up, and the events are vaguely alluded to, but the story is unto itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not a sequel, really. I mean, it's kind of a little bit of an offshoot of Gravesend, I guess, but definitely a standalone. So the main character is Amy Falconetti, who is a minor character in Gravesend. She's the hookup of Alessandra, the main character in Gravesend, and then this book is set about 6 or 7 years later, where they've had a relationship. Alessandra's left and Amy has stayed behind in Alessandra's neighborhood. Lots of place crossover, but you know, she's the main crossover, and Alessandra from Gravesend does appear in a kind of secondary role.
So why did you decide to approach it that way instead of starting with a new cast of characters?
I've always loved the idea of mythology and kind of building a mythology of a place. So I like the idea of returning to a character that we saw a little bit of and I really liked. But for me, it was mostly after Gravesend, I knew I wanted to write about Amy. I just kind of had an idea that she was a character that I worried about and wondered about. And I had an idea that at some point I'd write a book about her. I didn't know what at that time it would be, but I had an idea that there would be a book called Falconetti about her. So I started there, and then I just thought how interesting it would be if her and Alessandra had had this relationship and she stayed behind in this neighborhood, not being from there, being from Queens. Gravesend is driven by a hate crime, a young gay man, Duncan, in the early 90s, who's killed by Ray Boy, the kind of villain in that book. Amy is a gay woman. I thought here she is kind of trapped in this neighborhood, stuck in this neighborhood, but also simultaneously kind of starting this new, quiet, lonely, holy life.
It's not her neighborhood. It's Alessandra's neighborhood. Have you ever had an experience where you moved somewhere with somebody and then you got left behind in their place?
I haven't had that exact experience, I guess. In some sense, I guess I always feel, even in the place I'm from, like a little bit of an outsider. So I like the idea of seeing this neighborhood that I know so well, that my family still lives in, that I still return to a lot, through the eyes of an outsider. I thought it would give me a good way of talking about the neighborhood that, you know, maybe somebody who had lived there, there wouldn't be as much of the easy familiarity that a character like Alessandra or Conway in Gravesend had. I haven't had that exact experience, I don't think, but I've certainly lived in, my wife's family is from the Bronx, a neighborhood called Throgs Neck, and we lived there for a couple of years. And so I had the experience of being in a place that was kind of hers and wasn't mine. And I liked that feeling of kind of being a little bit of an outsider and learning the place. That was an interesting way, I think, of kind of setting Amy loose in the world. When I started, I knew I was going to start with her, but I didn't know exactly where she was going to be or what she was going to be doing.
How have the people back in Gravesend responded to your books?
My family's good with them. I don't really get a lot of feedback from any other people. You know, from the people that I know, family and friends and stuff, it's nothing but encouragement and support. I don't know who reads what and who doesn't, but so far so good. So where I'm from is kind of on the border of a couple of different neighborhoods, Gravesend and Bensonhurst, so a lot of family and friends there, but I guess okay. I haven't gotten anybody, you know, mad at me yet or anything that I know of.
Well, that's good. You don't want Omerita coming in your way.
Yeah, we'll see. I always dread, in Gravesend especially, I used a lot of names of kids I went to grammar school with. The characters weren't at all modeled on them. I, you know, haven't known most of those people since I was little, but I liked, you know, those names, you know, the way you remember names of everybody who you were in school with for 8 or 9 years. So I used a lot of those names. I always got worried I was going to get an email from somebody that was like, you know, what are you doing? But I haven't.
I noticed with a lot of the Italian names, they were more specific and not names that we kind of know in mass culture all through the country. Those are names I've never heard before.
Yeah. I haven't exhausted my kind of grade school and high school classmates, but I do love to go to, there's a funeral home in my neighborhood, and I go to their website and I just take names. I think several names in this book are from there. There was just like, I was looking for a name and I looked that day to see who had died, and there was somebody Pezzolani, and you know, somebody Epifania. It's kind of great music in those sorts of names that just adds a lot to everything. I mean, even in Gravesend, the last name of the Conway character is D'Innocenzio, which I never meant in any symbolic way. It was just, I picked up a newspaper at some point, and in the obituaries, there was somebody named D'Innocenzio, and I was like, I want to use that. That's a great name.
And so do you find the muse just find its way to you while you're writing?
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved naming. That's just such a great joy to me. My grandfather was somebody who, he wasn't a big reader or a writer, but he was somebody who gave everybody nicknames, never called me by my name, always called me. He had a variety of nicknames for me, mostly just called me the boy, but he had more inventive nicknames for people than that. So I've always loved naming things. Seeing unusual names in obituaries or in just in newspaper articles and kind of imagining things from there. I like signs too. You know, I mean, I love especially old signs. A lot of times I think I'll start with that, you know, the wrong number bar in Gravesend, the book. Really just in some ways started with my fascination with that sign. I didn't go to that bar often. It was a real bar in my neighborhood. I didn't go there often, but I loved the sign, and I just kind of imagined a fictional version of it based on the sign.
Now, with the neighborhood being named Gravesend, do you think there's a nominative determinism that comes about to your characters that way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, part of my struggle is I sort of write about, and I think it's probably a little bit more clear in this book than in Gravesend. I write as much about Bensonhurst as I do about Gravesend, probably. You know, neighboring neighborhoods. My house was technically in Gravesend, but everything, a lot of the things I did as a kid were in Bensonhurst. So I write about both neighborhoods a lot, but I always thought, God, I'm going to call something Gravesend. What a great name. What a lucky thing for me to kind of have that to fall back on as a place name to write about, to build my world out of. I always felt lucky to have that. I knew, you know, I knew I was never going to call a book Bensonhurst, but I had Gravesend, and I felt lucky.
And if people aren't necessarily familiar with it, it's the place you go through to get to Coney Island.
Yeah, it's kind of southern Brooklyn. So yeah, there's Coney Island, and then there's clustered over near there, Gravesend, Bensonhurst. Bath Beach is another neighborhood that we're kind of right on the border of. So yeah, that southern end of Brooklyn.
Why has Amy stuck around there for all these years after Alessandra left?
I think it's a neighborhood that is kind of on the margins of the city. It's not a destination. You know, it's not a place that people from out of state are going to move, really. I mean, I say that, but I mean, you know, like people from the United States. I have a lot of friends in Mississippi who have moved to Brooklyn in the last 5 or 6 years, and they moved to Williamsburg, or they moved to Greenpoint, or they moved to Bushwick or Bed-Stuy now, or Crown Heights. But it's not some place that those sorts of people are going to relocate to. It is an immigrant neighborhood still, a working class immigrant neighborhood. So it's predominantly Chinese American now. So I like the idea of Amy staying in this changing neighborhood and kind of hiding out there. I mean, I love that kind of noir setup of somebody kind of in exile or somebody hiding out in a place that it almost feels like she's kind of punishing herself by staying there a little bit, I think, that she's kind of trying to live some pious life that she can't live somewhere else. And because the place is lonely and because her life there is small and kind of quiet and narrow, she's finding something there that she hasn't had previously. So it just appealed to me, kind of having her stuck there.
But it doesn't seem like she has much to atone for.
No, I don't think she does. I mean, I think she's just kind of lost, you know, a little bit, just, you know, trying to figure out who she is and, you know, and kind of conflicted about who she is and where she is.
And she has a crush on a young woman who works in her parents' Chinese restaurant.
Right.
It seems that she kind of has trouble making positive changes in her life
and
moving forward with things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she does. I mean, I think she's, for whatever reason, she does, yeah.
As you mentioned, she's gay, and all the older Italian people that live in the neighborhood ask her when she's going to find a nice boy and get married. And she, I don't know if it's through kindness or just through wanting to avoid a problem, she never corrects them and tells them about herself.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it for her is maybe not revealing. She's kind of in character there a little bit. I mean, there's a lot of that in the book, that she kind of has these different identities. And I think she's kind of trying on this identity of not revealing anything about herself, or just kind of staying in hiding and not letting these personal details about her life slip, or having to explain something to, for instance, Mrs. Epifanio at the beginning of the book, who's 90, you know, and she doesn't really see anything that could be useful in kind of trying to make a 90-year-old woman understand who she is. So, I mean, I think in some ways she feels some comfort in not having to kind of correct that or to set that right.
But somehow or another, the word's gotten out that she has tattoos.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know exactly know how that information got out there.
Yeah. I don't know how that got out there. I think she thinks somebody saw her in a tank top at some point or something.
But it's a small town, so everybody talks.
Yeah, everybody. There's a lot of that, a lot of nosiness, a lot of gossip. Yeah, that's one of the great joys of writing. I mean, my neighborhood, I think, is kind of I write it anyway, and I think it is like this. As a small town in a big city, it has a lot of that feeling of, you know, everybody knows everybody's business, everybody's got something to say.
Yeah, and for being in one of the world's great cities,
yeah,
it's really provincial there as well.
Yeah. People have some very, especially people not from New York, I think, have some very set ideas about New York City, but New York City is a big city, and they're especially in these neighborhoods that are kind of at the edges of the city or last stops on the subway line, can sometimes feel like that, can sometimes feel as removed from culture and everything as the country. I felt that way as a kid. I felt cut off from things. I didn't know any better. I didn't, you know, Manhattan was 45 minutes subway ride away. I hardly ever went there until high school. It was another galaxy to me, you know. I mean, we didn't have anything really great in my neighborhood other than some good food. So it wasn't like a cultural place.
But Coney Island wasn't too far away.
Coney Island wasn't too far away, but Coney Island wasn't really, when I was growing up, it was pretty rough. It had gone through its kind of darkest, worst period in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s. And only recently, in the late 90s, early 2000s especially, has it kind of bounced back a little bit. But it was not really a destination anymore in my childhood.
I just found out recently that Michael Beck, who played the lead, Swan, in The Warriors.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was from Memphis.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow.
He went to Memphis University School.
Oh, wow.
I think he grew up in Eastern Arkansas, but he came over here for high school.
Nice. I didn't know that. That's cool. I love the Warriors.
It would be so great to be a baseball fury.
Yeah. Truly.
Now, as you mentioned, she's helping out Mrs. Epifanio at the beginning of the book, and I didn't even know this was possible. She's delivering communion to the homebound.
Yeah. I was home. My grandmother's 90, 91 now, but she's in a nursing home the last year or so, but she was still at home before that, and, you know, she used to go to church every day, basically, until she couldn't anymore, just a couple of years ago, really, I think up until she was 88 or 89. So when she stopped being able to go, even on Saturdays or Sundays, that's when somebody started coming to deliver her communion. So that was basically where the book started for me, really. I mean, I knew I wanted to start there, that there was communion being delivered. I was home, and communion was delivered to my grandma, and I had that idea that someone was there. I didn't even really know it was going to be Amy at first. I had this idea that I wanted to write a book about Amy, and then I had this idea that I'd start a book with this, just kind of right out of the gate, somebody delivering communion, but she gets there and there's been somebody else in the house and she doesn't know what's going on. And then I realized, oh, that person's Amy. She's in the neighborhood. So, yeah.
Why did you pick St. Teresa, the little flower?
My mom loves St. Teresa. I think maybe there was some of that there. But I'd also been, whatever I'm reading, watching, listening to works itself into what I'm writing. And at the time I was reading a biography of Dorothy Day, and was really just kind of thinking about Dorothy Day a lot. And Dorothy Day wrote a book about St. Teresa. And so I kind of just thought, Amy would be into Dorothy Day. Amy would be into St. Teresa. It just kind of fell into place from there.
So when she goes over to Mrs. Epifanio's apartment, Miss Epifanio is worried that a woman who comes and sits with her several days a week, Diane, hasn't made it over.
Right.
Beyond the worry of her not being there, there's an extra element that's added to this. And why is Vincent such a problem?
Vincent is Diane the caretaker's son, and he's come in place of his mother 2 or 3 days in a row, I can't remember, and he's freaked Mrs. Epifanio out. He's come and he's acted irrationally, and he's gone into her bedroom and done something, she doesn't know what. Amy at first is not sure if he's real or not. He thinks Mrs. Epifanio might be having a kind of dementia.
And she's seen a couple of those before.
Yeah. She's heard that the priest who organizes this has told her, you know, she's prone to, these kind of, I don't know what they're called.
Kind of delusional.
Yeah, delusional, just kind of, my grandmother's got that. You know, she sees often people who aren't there. For a long time, she would see these kids in her house that weren't there. But now, mostly, she's kind of slipped a little further into dementia, and she sees, like, people from her childhood, her parents. And so Amy thinks it's that, but it winds up that Vincent shows up while she's there. She says she'll hang out with Mrs. Epifanio and confront this person if indeed he's real, and he is real, and he shows up and he acts crazy, and Amy kind of chases him away for a second.
Now, will there ever be a character in a book who vapes who's a good person?
I don't think so. And that's pretty good indicator, probably, right? I wasn't trying to do that, I don't think, but it seemed like such a good
tell
for, yeah. And it seemed like just something he would do. I didn't know that until I wrote it, I don't think. And it just made sense for that character that he would be walking through his vape smoke, or is it called smoke? I hope it's called smoke.
Probably vapor.
Vapor. I don't know what it's called. I think I call it smoke in the book. That's cool.
Now, we talked about Mrs. Epifanio's delusions, but there is a visual trick that comes on Amy at this time, and Vincent reminds her of a man named Bob Tully.
Right.
And why is that such a bad thing?
So when she was in high school, she witnessed a murder from her bedroom window. Her neighbor, Bob Tully, killed a guy in his driveway, strangled him, and she witnessed it. And so this comes back to her. It doesn't make a big kind of entrance into the narrative, except to kind of give us a sense of why Amy would be so drawn to following Vincent. She kind of, I think, maybe felt a little alive in seeing Bob Tully. Well, not so much in seeing Bob Tully commit the crime, but in the time after he committed the crime. She wound up kind of obsessing over it a little bit and following
him. Because he had noticed her.
Right.
In the flagrante.
Yeah, yeah. So she wound up keeping her mouth shut, but following him around the neighborhood and kind of doing a little amateur sleuth thing, trying to figure out what had happened, but never reporting the crime. So yeah, that comes back to her in this moment. Vincent makes her think of this guy. And it also kind of sets up, you know, her desire to follow Vincent, which she does, you know, for no good reason really, other than curiosity to see who is this guy, what's he doing, why is he coming into Mrs. Epifanio's house, what did he do in the bedroom, is his mother dead, did he kill his mother, you know, what's the story with this guy?
You make Tully Irish, I guess.
Right.
But almost everyone else in the story is Italian.
Yeah.
So you've got this Irish guy making bad things in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Of course, I'm a Twin Peaks fanatic, David Lynch fanatic. So I like the idea of this Bob in Twin Peaks. I like the idea of this Bob, who's kind of this kind of almost mystical bad guy from her past.
Also in Amy's past, she was kind of a rockabilly.
Yeah.
Why the specific choice of rockabilly as one of her things?
That's what she is in Gravesend. In Gravesend, when we meet her, she's just a rockabilly girl. That's her style. I don't remember what I was thinking when I wrote that originally. I think I just kind of, like most things, I had Alessandra get to that bar, Seven Bar. And this is in Gravesend, the first appearance of Amy. Alessandra gets to that bar, and Amy's bartending. And that's just the way she showed up in that book. I don't think when I originally wrote it that I even knew they were going to hook up, that Alessandra was going to go home with Amy. That just kind of happened. And I certainly didn't know at that point that I'd be writing a book about that character. So that was her past, you know. I mean, I just had to stick with that past, you know. I mean, that was one of the things I knew about her after Gravesend. I just kind of saw her as that. She was a record collector. She was big into Social Distortion and the Cramps. And
she wasn't kind of a manic pixie dream girl, was she?
No. I never pictured her like that. I just, style-wise, I just thought, again, you know, it wound up working out well for this book because it was an identity she tried on. It was a costume. You know, it was a way of being in the world that I think made sense to her for a time. She enjoyed the fashion. She enjoyed the specific fashion rules that she kind of had to abide by and fit her, that she would kind of fall into that world.
And you had mentioned that she kept old cassettes like L7, Sonic Youth,
right.
Pixies like that. And so that actually kind of makes that time period when those bands were getting wider notice makes a good connection to the original Crime from Gravesend.
Yeah.
Kind of ties it to that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think music kind of is always playing into all that stuff for me. So any connections I can make in that way are good for me personally, just in terms of building the mythology, I think.
When she was young, her father left the family, mm-hmm. and her mom died, and she was raised by her grandparents. And her grandparents have since passed. She's on her own. So many of the older people in the neighborhood are desperately lonely and want people to talk to. Just any excuse,
right.
Even if you just happen to be walking by, they offer you a cup of coffee and come on in. And it just there's just this sense of loneliness that just is throughout the end. I know it's in the title, but still.
Yeah, I think so. That's definitely something that I'm interested in writing about and kind of understanding. You know, I mean, I think you have all these people that the neighborhood is not just the neighborhood, really, the world, I guess. It's kind of peopled with these, you know, characters who are atoning for something or trying to atone for something or have all these lost relationships. Mrs. Epifanio has, you know, doesn't see her daughter much. Mr. Pezzolani, Amy's landlord, you know, his son passed away. So there's all these kind of reasons why people are lonely. Some of them have estranged relationships with family members. Or I'm really interested in how people try to make up for that in their life. And Amy becomes the focus of that because she's nice. And this version of herself is quiet and to herself. I think a lot of people that she meets, especially these lonely old people, are trying to draw her in and have her be their confidant or have her be somebody they can have as a daughter, essentially, or at least a friend.
And it's very interesting, but can you put a finger on why you find it interesting in particular?
Just from personal experience, really. I mean, I think it's something that I've seen as somebody who didn't have a relationship with his father. You know, I mean, I think that I'm really always interested in that and the ways people try to connect and the ways that people kind of live these lonely lives but are searching for something else.
She decides to follow Vincent because they're worried about his mother, Diane.
Right.
Because they can't reach her at all on the telephone, and they're worried that he might have done something to her because he's acting so erratically.
Yeah.
And she follows him to the home stretch.
Right.
So what kind of place is the home stretch?
Another little kind of divey sports bar, an actual bar in Bensonhurst, kind of right on the border of Bensonhurst and Gravesend. I haven't spent a whole lot of time there, not far from my mom and grandma's house. But it was a place that I just kind of, again, was drawn to because of the great sign. It's a really great old dive bar sign. And my version of it is a kind of fictionalization of the real bar. But it's a little close to the actual place. So, yeah, it's a kind of dive bar. And she follows him there and sees a kind of mysterious encounter and is just kind of drawn further into the web of who Vincent is and what his story is and just what's going on in his life.
Now, at this point, I'm a little hesitant on how much we should give away. I know it
happens
like in the first eighth of the book.
Yeah.
But there's the inciting action that really gets things rolling. And do you
right.
want to talk about it at all?
I'm good with talking about it. I don't really believe in spoilers anyway, but I think it's on the book flap, too. So Vincent is murdered, and Amy witnesses it while she's following him. Of course, that draws her even further, and she's trying to understand what happened. She picks up the weapon at the crime scene. The murderer flees and drops the knife that he used. And then she kind of wanders away with the knife after watching Vincent die.
Crime novels are so often driven by bad decisions that people make. So how do you balance people making a believable bad decision versus someone that's just flat out stupid?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know if I have a great answer for it, but I think that you know, it's kind of easy to make bad decisions, you know, I mean, especially when you're driven by curiosity or when you're driven by some kind of dark desire for something, even if you don't understand what it is. So, yeah, I mean, I think for me, you know, Amy's kind of in that moment imagined herself into, like, she has some purpose in this moment. She sees it as an opportunity to do something. So she does think it's a bad decision eventually, but in the moment, I don't know if she thinks it's a bad decision. It's a decision that makes sense to her. And it made sense to her. It kind of made sense to me, you know?
So what was the last bad decision you've made that you're willing to admit to?
Geez, that's a good question. I've probably made several in the last few days. Probably, I was in Greenwood last night and they gave me like a big glass of Rebel Yell. That was probably not a good decision.
In the prose style of the book, use the present tense.
Yeah.
For a third person narration, which, you know, more often when it's used, it's usually a first person. Why did you choose that?
You know, I'd never written in the present tense. Well, that's not totally true. So Gravesend's in the past. There's a book that I wrote before The Lonely Witness called A Friend is a Gift You Give Yourself, which is actually going to come out next. But I wrote most of that book before I started The Lonely Witness. And then I went back to it after I finished The Lonely Witness and wrote a new, you know, another 100 pages or so. It needed a third act or whatever, final movement that I hadn't seen originally. That book I wrote in the present tense, and I really liked it. I'd never done it before. I don't think I'd ever done it really before. Maybe in some old first-person story I wrote when I was just kind of first starting to write stories. But I fell into the rhythm of it, and I pretty much, the day after I finished my first draft of that book, I started The Lonely Witness, and I'd been in such a good rhythm with that book that I was just like, trying to carry it over to this book, and I just kind of fell into that. It just kind of was what made sense. It felt suddenly more urgent to me. It felt like it matched the tone of the book. I knew that I wanted to kind of start right out of the gate with this almost kind of like Vertigo-esque beginning of just, we're right in the mystery. We're not getting exposition, backstory. We're just kind of starting. Here's Amy. Here's Vincent. Let's see what happens. And so it just made sense to write it in the present. I was writing it in February 2017. I started writing it, I think, in February 2017, which is the month it takes place. So it made sense in that way, too.
When you're writing, was it easy to stay in the present tense, or did you have to go back while you were drafting and go, I slipped into the past tense there?
I was surprised that now when I try to write in the past tense, I find it hard. I'm writing something now that is in the past tense, and now I'm finding it hard to not slip into the present. But during the writing of that book, I didn't find it hard at all. I was really comfortable in writing in the present. The book I started after that, I've also written in the present tense, so that one's not done yet, but that would be three in a row where I was in the present. So I just felt very, I don't know, felt suited to me all of a sudden.
And, of course, we referred to Gravesend, the book, several times. It's getting a reissue.
Yeah. Well, it just came out in January in the UK. So there's a cool paperback No Exit Press edition that came out in January that's pretty available, I think, in the U.S. right now. I don't know how that works, but currently it seems pretty available. And then Pegasus Crime, my publisher on The Lonely Witness, is reissuing it in hardcover in September, which I'm really excited about. And there'll be some supplemental stuff, introduction by Alex Andreas, a interview I did with the Los Angeles Review of Books, and then my large-hearted boy playlist for the book. So that's cool.
Well, William, I want to thank you so much for stopping by, and I'm so glad we had a chance to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Stephen. It's always my pleasure.
William Boyle is the author of The Lonely Witness, published by Pegasus Books. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.